This time, Dr. Louis C. Jones, director of the New York State Historical Association in Cooperstown, New York. Now, you have a biographical sketch of him on your program, and I don't want to use up his time, so I am not going to repeat it. I'm just going to say that he is primarily a regionalist. His interest is in the various regions of our country. His own region, of course, as you can see from his little life story there, is upstate New York. But as a scholar of regional America, he has, of course, become an expert on all regions. His lecture this morning is entitled A Long Look Over the Left Shoulder. I would encourage you also to come to lectures number 2 and 3. Notice on your program that this evening's lecture is at 6:30. This is an unusual hour, but I hope it will prove to be a convenient one for you. And his title is A Nosegay of Pretty Murders. I have a feeling that this sounds like the lecture that will be the most fun, and so I would encourage you to come. And tomorrow at 10 o'clock, again in the recreation room, an illustrated lecture, Folk Artists as Reporters. And I hope you'll all be able to take in the entire series. So for this morning, a long look over the left shoulder, Dr. Louis Jones.
Thank you, Professor Strong. I'm very pleased to be here in this distinguished college, especially in following two of my very old and very close friends, Mr. Carmer and Mr. Warner, and as a matter of fact, a younger friend, Mr. Fishwick, of a few years ago. They've been telling me for some time, some months now, the pleasures of having been Lamar lecturer, and I'm pleased and flattered to follow them. I might say a word about this series because the three lectures are related. I'm going to talk this morning about what, for want of a better term, I call American folk culture. I wish there were a better term. And then tonight, I'm going to talk about, well, of course, partly I'm going to talk about murder as a fine art, but partly, too, more particularly, I think, I'm going to talk about it as a source of information about the past, how we can learn from murder trials things that we can't from any other source that I know. And tomorrow I will talk about our more naive painters and show you a good many pictures to, if not prove my point, at least make my point. One evening, nearly 40 years ago, there came to the little college where I was an undergraduate, Mr. Carl Sandburg. And Carl, in those days, was going around the country doing several things. He was working on his great six-volume Life of Lincoln. He was still writing poetry, and he had just about completed the collection of American folk songs, which was to be published in 1927 as the American Song Bag, that first great collection of American folk songs. I remember the evening very well. I was a kind of pale imitator of Carl's poetry in those days. I've never had the courage to reread it, but this, you'll find, those of you that are writing poetry now, is a kind of endemic disease of college poetry writers. Either they go on and do much better or they stop. And I had hoped to hear a good deal of his poetry and about his poetry. Instead of that, he divided his lecture into three parts, one part on his poetry, one part on Lincoln, and one part he got out his guitar and sang these songs, the like of which I had never heard. I ought to say to you, I think, that you're not to confuse what in our current jargon passes for folk song, The young record makers are busy making folk songs of their own. It always reminds me of a sign I once saw in a young college where I was visiting. Starting tonight, there will be a tradition that we will do so-and-so. This is what happens to folk song, but Carl was to a large extent talking about songs that had been current in this country for some time. And I can't say I was very much impressed. And yet, a few months later in New York, in a secondhand bookstore, I ran across the American Song Bag and bought it. And little realized that that evening and that purchase were to alter my thinking tremendously. I was always interested in English and Scottish ballads, as I found them in literature courses. And here I found that those same songs were sung in this country. And then I found that there were other songs with the same themes made up in this country. And from there, I wandered into other areas and discovered that there was a whole body of song and story and legend and custom and particularly belief that had survived in this country as it had survived earlier in Europe from the telling of mothers to daughters and fathers to sons. Some of this had gotten into print and had encouraged the telling. Much of it had not gotten into print and survived from tongue to ear and tongue to ear through the generations. Well, I was growing older and the time came when I was teaching, and for some years I taught courses in American folklore in this oral tradition. And I found it an exciting and rewarding kind of area. Then about almost 20 years ago, 18 years ago, I went to the little village of Cooperstown where they had just started one of the first bona fide American folk museums in the sense the phrase is used in Europe. Our farmer's museum was designed to tell the story of the working farmer. Not only the farmer, but his wife and his children and the craftsmen in the little crossroads who served him. In other words, it was a museum designed to tell the story of working people in our part of the world, in upstate New York. As I moved from the word to the thing, from folklore to this three-dimensional history, which I found myself handling as a museum director, I became more and more aware of the fact that the same principles of tradition applied to farm techniques, to building techniques, to cooking, to the preparation of flax and wool, to the weaving of linen, to fishing, and a thousand other areas. Exactly the same things happened in this tradition as happened in the oral tradition, because in a sense it was the outcome of an oral tradition. Nearly 75 years ago, 80 years ago, there began in Scandinavia, first in Sweden and then in Norway and then later in Denmark, great collections of country tools, country implements, the bringing in of rural houses and barns, and the decorative arts of the people who had lived in them. The European concept of folklore grew out of this, which is a different concept than ours. To the Europeans, folklore is actually folk life. The whole way of people, the whole way of a people, the whole way of a people insofar as it is not dependent upon books, upon the classical tradition of a culture. Out of these collections in Europe came research in the universities, came studies that went beyond the thing to the people who used the thing. There has been in this country up to the present time almost no attempt to bring the study of folk life, of the way simple people lived, the way the core of a people lived, into relationship with the things that they used and had. We had little folk museums in this country, I suppose, in the sense that we had county historical societies, which were actually sort of community attics, where everything went. The bullet that killed Captain so-and-so, and the hat that was lost in such and such a battle, and so on. And in a way, these had the makings of folk museums, but they were totally oriented in another direction. They were oriented in the association of objects. That old kind of sympathetic, contagious magic, rather, where something has value because it's touched something else. Washington's underpants, I suppose, is the great example. Not until after World War II did we in this country begin to think in terms of a museum that told the whole story of a people at a simple level. Williamsburg had, starting in the 20s, emphasized the life of the plantation owners. But after World War II, more and more their emphasis was upon the craftsmen, the workers in the community. And at Sturbridge Village and with us in Cooperstown, we began to develop a relationship, a telling of a whole story, of a way of life. We also tried, in our way, to add to this with courses in an adult education program that we carry on the summer called the Seminars in American Culture, where Professor Strong and some others in these parts have joined us. Where our emphasis always is on the traditional as opposed to the book-based. Slowly out of these various things has begun to emerge for us the sense of a culture pattern. And this culture pattern, and I think this is going to be true wherever this is studied, is based on folklore, on the objects that have come down to us, and on the use of the library as a research tool. I'm impressed, the more I learn, in a kind of struggling way, is how much popular misconception there is about the past. And the related fact that there is an amazing dearth of sound research on the way people did live and think and feel. What we need more and more, and what today I speak for, is the need for sound scholarly research that will lead us to a better understanding of our own roots. Now, we're not concerned in this kind of thing with the leaders of a community. The biographical field has been covered well in this country. We are much more concerned with the followers. We are not so concerned with the mansion as we are with the farmhouse and cabin. We are not so concerned with the great poem as with the song remembered or the verse told by the fire. The mountain feud is more our concern than a war. The courting customs of the young men and women of a community more our dish of tea than an international treaty. I think the assumption in this country, of course, down to about 1930, among historians, was that politics and law and wars were the most important aspect of history. But even the social historians who rose in the 30s, late 20s and 30s, to offset this, have a tendency to emphasize the great architecture rather than the average architecture, the best paintings rather than the common paintings. The decorative arts in the great houses and the best writings of the ablest authors. All this we need to know, and I'm not for a moment saying we don't, but I think we need to see the other side of the coin, to get an understanding not of the foliage, but of the taproots of a culture. It seems to me that the way of life of a country farm family, which stands for thousands of families, may teach us more about ourselves, their descendants, and our times, which have followed theirs, than the study of life on a plantation. Now, in the United States, there is unquestionably across the country and up and down the country, there is a kind of common tradition. There is a body of culture which is common from Maine to San Diego. Those of us who have collected folk songs have found, for example, many of the same songs all over the country. I've been interested in ghost lore for years. And every time a new collection of ghost tales come out, and I'm thinking now about the traditional ghost tales, I am impressed again by the fact that practically all the ones that we find current among the people were also to be found in my state 20 years ago when I was collecting, and in North Carolina 20 to 35 years ago when Professor Brown was collecting the great Brown collection of North Carolina folklore. The same thing is true in relation to many kinds of folk art, many kinds of tools and implements. The wool wheel and the techniques of spinning and weaving vary very little from part to part. But because it's a big country, and because of differences in climate, because of the early and continuing differences in the balance of national and racial origins, because of the differences in agriculture, because of the differences in proximity to the coast, and so the world beyond the sea, and because of the differences of when the land was settled, we find remarkable and extremely interesting regional differences. These regions do not follow political lines necessarily. Sometimes there is a sharp cleavage at a political line, but very often there is not. For example, it seems to me that if you were to study, if you were to take the states of Georgia and North and South Carolina and Virginia and treat them in terms of their folk culture, you would find that you have a mountain culture, a Piedmont culture, and a tidewater culture. And that these go at all, not at right angles, but a 45 degree angle to the geographical lines. I've often wondered what the history of the South would have been if the young states, the young colonies, had lain northeast by southwest instead of east and west. If, let's say, there were two mountain states and two Piedmont states and two coastal states. Silly ways of amusing myself is to redraw the map of the United States, taking all the bumps out, all the little cracks and crevices that don't have any sense unless you know the history of that particular spot. You ought to see what I do to New England. For example, I think a farm family in southern Pennsylvania, a mountain family, for example, in southern Pennsylvania, would probably have far more in common with a mountain family in North Carolina Then you would think at first possible. One of my students, one of our graduate students at the Cooperstown Graduate Center, is doing a study of Southern folk architecture. And he finds that there are architectural patterns that follow right along the whole length of the Blue Ridge, from its northern anchor in southern Pennsylvania down into Georgia. And if this is true of architecture, and we're talking now about folk architecture, the kind of architecture that is traditional, that you, where you build the house the way grandfather built his, this is also true of many other aspects of the culture. One of the points I want to make this morning is the variety of areas where one must go to find the materials out of which this kind of understanding of our cultural roots lie. First of all, one must use the techniques of the folklorist. One must go out with a tape recorder and training and talk to the old rememberers, to the people who have not been, whose memories have not been spoiled by too much reading, if any. Who still have vestiges of a pre-television culture in their minds. And fortunately, there's more of it left than we tend to think. But here are still songs and stories, and particularly stories of a way of life, relationships that we can only get, I think, from human memory. Then I think if we're going to get a total picture, we have to look at the material objects. Years in the museum have taught me how much we can learn by looking at the way a building is made, by the tools in the barnyard and in the barn, and the implements in the kitchen and in the attic. Because not only is the object of interest and tells a story, but if we can combine this with our folklore, we can find out what the hand skills were that gave the object, the tool, the implement meaning. And of course the library. Books, yes, but often it's the local histories, the reminiscences of old men published in the 70s and 80s or even 50s and 60s. Diaries, letters, old newspapers, not so much for the news, which in the early days was often a foreign news, but the advertisements, often giving us some marvelous insights to the everyday life of people. We wondered, for example, we wanted to put in a garden at our farmer's museum a few years ago, a flower garden. Well, the question is, what kind of flowers did women on the frontier have in upstate New York? Well, we found in a newspaper for 1812 that the druggist was advertising the seeds that had just come into his drugstore. It gave us a range of about 50 different flowers and another 50 vegetable seeds, all of which were current and available in 1812. It also calls to mind the fact that the drugstore of the early 19th century on the frontier was just as miscellaneous in the things it sells as the modern drugstore, where you can now get everything from dog food to wristwatches. And especially in the library, one finds an amazing amount of information about the way people lived, not to say died, from murder trials and criminal trials. I hope some of you will come and share with me my pleasure in this sort of thing tonight. There is a kind of excitement about reading through an old murder trial that has nothing to do with a modern detective story. I always have a feeling that the modern detective story is sticky kid stuff, you know, and you ought to grow up and work with the real trials. In our new graduate program with the State University, which we have at Albany, at Cooperstown, rather, our graduate students have been doing some of the sort of thing that I think needs to be done. We have let them follow their own interests so that the range of subject is very scattered. But it is out of hundreds of pieces of research of this sort that I think gradually we'll pull together a kind of bona fide picture of what life was like in this country, let's say, down to the middle of the last century. One of our students, for example, is doing an essay, a thesis, on the role of death in the Northeast. All of the art, all of the memorial pieces, the customs of the funeral, the custom, for example, of coffin plates framed and kept in the parlor, the memorial art, the patterns of hospitality at the time of the funeral, and so on. Another man is working on the blacksmith and what the blacksmith made in a small town over a period of about 50 years, from a little longer than that, from 1785 to 1850. The blacksmith, you know, was a kind of a jack of all trades. He often was not a very good blacksmith. He had to do too many things to perfect his art. The tradition of that the American, the early American craftsman was a fine craftsman just isn't true. He, largely because he did not have good training in the first place, in the second place, he had to do too many different things. He had to be a jack of too many trades. Well, I mentioned Mr. Glassy's work on the folk house types of the southern mountains. One of our girls is working on the range and variety of fences. And she has been carrying her researches back to medieval paintings, where she discovers exactly the same kind of fences that are still current in our countryside, and I'm sure in yours. Well, I could go on and give you a whole group of others, but I think that gives you some idea of the kind of thing that I think has to be done in a variety of places, in a variety of regions, so that we ultimately come out with a clarified picture that shows us what our real differences and our real similarities are. Because I think often we are unaware of in how many ways parts of the country that we think of as quite different had very common grounds. Let me give you an example of the kind of major research project that I hope will come gradually out of these studies and studies yet to be started. One of the basic differences, it seems to me, between your part of the world and my part of the world, the South and the North, is the structure and concept of the family. In the North, there are certainly an infinite variety of familial patterns, some very close-knit, but very many loosely knit. I suppose my own family is fairly characteristic. I have two sisters, both a little older than I. We live 75 and 125 miles apart. We usually see each other briefly once a year, but not necessarily all three of us together. We are excellent friends, but unless we're in trouble, we don't think of getting together. I have five cousins, four of whom I haven't seen in 30 years, and two of whom I don't even know where they live. My three children have 5 cousins and 10 first cousins once removed, and I doubt if they or I know the names of all of those kinsmen. I would guess that while this sort of family pattern is common in my world, it is far more uncommon than common here. I think the difference is that the South has a sense of family that we don't have. But one begins to ask, how long have you had it? And when did it begin to develop, and under what circumstances? What factors encouraged it? And how frequently, and I gather very frequently, but I don't know, how frequently does it cut across economic and social lines? When one corner of the family has gone up in the social scale and another has gone down, one begins to ask, what relationship is accepted as a good relationship between parents and children? What has been the ideal over the last 150 years? What does the community look on as a good father-son, mother-daughter, mother-son, father-daughter relationship? And especially interesting, it seems to me, is the question of what is the good brother-sister, brother-brother, sister-sister, the sibling relationship? Because it is out of the sibling relationships, and this, I think, is where perhaps the great difference comes between North and South. It is out of the sibling relationship that the relationship with the cousins come. Cousins know each other because the parents are continuing to be close friends as well as kinsmen. And then there is, for the Northerner, that puzzling problem, a puzzling aspect of the family problem in the South, that is the so-called artificial relations. The kissing cousins, and I'm not sure that I yet know what a kissing cousin is, though it sounds attractive. The uncles, in quotes, the aunts, in quotes, who are often friends of the parents and are included in the thinking of the family pattern. Now, the novelists and playwrights have utilized this aspect of Southern life, both very critically and very affectionately. But I think what we need is a historically based, historically oriented, and objective study of this aspect of your lives. And we ought to have enough material from other parts of the country to see in what ways it differs, if it does differ as much as some of us think it does. I'm intensely interested in the byproducts of this kind of traditional familial pattern, the traditions of hospitality, the visits, the open-handedness, the warmth of welcome, which is one of your great and charming qualities. I'm interested in the effect of this on architecture. What is the relation of this to the veranda, for example? Enough space so that there can be socializing, not only for the family under the roof, but the part of the family that comes to visit under the roof. Now, I remind you that I am not thinking here of the plantation. I am thinking right across the line, at all social levels and over a long period of time. I'm thinking, too, of holidays and how they're celebrated, of eating habits and table manners, not to say other manners, and the tradition of cooking that made all this bearable. The folklore that comes through a family, the songs and games that filter down from grandfather to grandchild, the family stories, the local family legends, the folk history, if you will, the beliefs told in as stories or told as realities, the ghost law, the stories of witchcraft that was. What did this mean? What does the family pattern in the South mean to the young person in relation to physical objects in the family, the furniture that's been there a long time, the family antiques, the paintings and decorative arts, if any. And especially, and I think this is perhaps the most important thing of all, the most important byproduct, the sense of ethic. The sense that we don't do such and such in this family, or we do such and such in this family. Well, as you will see, this kind of broad, comprehensive study that I think of, and this is only one example of which I could give you, given a little time, hundreds that I would like to see done if we're going to understand ourselves better, calls upon the skills of the social historian, for only with historical perspective can it have meaning. The techniques of the sociologist, the folklorist, and perhaps the psychiatrist to help us analyze the human relationships, and the anthropologist. But I think the time has come when we Americans as a people have got to understand these roots of our own better, and the basic culture upon which our modern culture is built. In conclusion, I would like to answer the unspoken criticism that much of this really is unimportant. Well, who knows what's important? We've reached the point where pure science, research in pure science, is accepted even by congressmen. It seems to me that the social sciences need the same kind of groping into all directions as the physical sciences. But I'm convinced, too, that much of the kind of thing that I have in mind bears a relationship in many of the troubled fields of our own civilization. We hear a good deal about juvenile delinquency. I think part of the trouble with juvenile delinquency is that we don't see it in historic perspective. We don't see it in terms of all of its past complexities. In New York, where I visit a good deal, New York City, they're deeply concerned about juvenile delinquency these days, but they forget that in the 1850s, there were gangs of hundreds of wandering, homeless, ruthless adolescents, not only destroying property and fighting with each other and molesting the public generally, but carrying on organized wars with the police. They had marvelous names. One of my favorite gangs was known as the Dead Rabbits, for reasons which I've never been able to determine. We think people are worried in our time about the divorce rate. Well, this is a serious matter, but is it as out of proportion as we think? Or is it merely that are there more unhappy marriages than there used to be? I don't know. I don't think so, frankly. But far be it for me to guess in an area where I believe that only research can bring the answers. But I tell you this, that as you go through the country newspapers of the early 19th century, you find over and over again this kind of advertisement. Abelenk, my wife, having left my habitation and taking all our household furniture and has made unnecessary debts, and I understand is making more, I, Jacob Kibbe, refuse to be responsible therefore. And the next week, another ad. I, Abelenk Kibbe, do refuse to live with Jacob Kibbe, and not without just provocation. He squanders away all his and my own earnings in rioting and drunkenness, and makes no provision for my support nor that of my 10 children. He has without provocation been the aggressor, and to me the cause of more trouble than I ever endured before, and I will not be responsible for his debts. Well, marriages have always been happy and unhappy. And I think it may be that we will find in the long run that it isn't so much that marriages are more unhappy, but more people are refusing to put up with unhappy marriages. I'm convinced that much of what waits to be learned in this field has very immediate use then. But if it doesn't, if it doesn't do that, at least it should give us perspective and proportion, which must be the basis, the basic goal of any educated person. Perspective and proportion. It should erase some of the cliches that lead us, and sometimes our leaders, to say silly things about the good old days, that golden never-never land, when every child was good, every woman virtuous, every man noble, every marriage happy, and every politician honest and intelligent. If I have learned anything from a third of a century of studying the folkways of my people, it is that the balance of good and evil in men and women remains about constant, that there never was a time without problems or a life without troubles, that fear cripples and blinds, and that love liberates and fortifies. Thank you.
I think we might as well start our program. Latecomers can still drift in. I'm not going to introduce Dr. Jones again. I did this morning. I am going to say that one of the things you should do sometime is go to Cooperstown, see his museums, and if possible, attend the seminars on American culture, which are held there in the summer. I was there just one summer for those seminars, just for my own entertainment and education. And then, some years later, I came to Wesleyan and found myself with some of the responsibility for the Lamar Lecture Series on American culture, and my mind immediately went back to Cooperstown. And so I invited Mr. Frank Warner, whom I had met at those seminars, and when he was leaving, I said, "Now, do you have some suggestions for later Lamar lecturers?" And he said, "Well, now, you ought to get Lou Jones down, but he's starting a new graduate program up there, so he wouldn't be available next year. And you ought to have Carl Carmer. He might come." I said, "Well, will these people come this distance?" Well, we finally left it that Mr. Warner would go back, and he would give them glowing accounts of what wonderful people we are, and what a marvelous time he had, and how well he was received. And after he had had enough time to do this, then I would write and say, "How would you like to come?" So when Mr. Carmer was here last year, I said, "Do you have any suggestions?" And he said, "Well, I think you might be able to pull Dr. Jones away from his graduate program now that it's well underway. I've run out of Cooperstown people at this point, but you should go some summer. I can assure you, you meet the most interesting people at the seminars on American culture in Cooperstown." And so down from Cooperstown for our Lamar Lecture Series this year, we do have Dr. Louis Jones, director of the Farmers Museum, Fenimore House, operated by the New York State Historical Association, and director of these marvelous new graduate programs leading to Master of Arts degrees in History Museum Training and American Folk